You're listening to The Space Show with Andrew Rennie on 88.3 Solon FM. Kepler is a space telescope designed to stare continuously at a tiny patch of stars, looking for planets that orbit them. To do so, it needs to point very accurately at the stars. Kepler was launched by the United States on 2009, March the 7th. The satellite has four reaction wheels that spin gyroscopically to maintain pointing. A minimum of three wheels are needed. In July last year, reaction wheel number two failed. Kepler was able to maintain pointing using the remaining reaction wheels numbers one, three, and four. Science data collection continued. Now, pointing is normally maintained to within an arc second. To explain what an arc second is, a full circle is divided into 360 degrees. 1 degree is divided into 60 arc minutes, and 1 arc minute is divided into 60 arc seconds. So you see, it's a very tiny angle. Now, to help you visualize how accurate Kepler's pointing system needs to be, imagine the satellite were above Melbourne. Kepler would be able to keep a steady stare at an outdoor cinema screen in Perth. And to maintain that unwavering stare 24 hours a day for years at a time. And that's how accurate you need to be to detect planets orbiting distant stars, to be able to look at the cinema in Perth, Western Australia, from here in Melbourne. Well, Kepler began to show more problems with its gyroscopic pointing system in January this year. On the 17th of that month, the craft entered a wheel rest safe mode as a precaution. 10 days later, Kepler returned to Science Data Collection, and all went well throughout February and early March. The reaction wheel number four exhibited high levels of friction. The gyroscopic system allows the satellite to continuously point at its target stars. It also allowed mission controllers to command, once a month, the spacecraft to turn away and point its high-gain antenna towards Earth. This allowed the previous month's observation data to be radioed to Earth at 4.3 megabits per second. Now, Kepler requires extremely precise pointing to detect the faint periodic dimming of distant starlight. This dimming is the telltale sign of a planet transiting the face of its host star. Too much friction from the reaction wheels can cause vibration. This vibration impacts the pointing precision of the telescope. During its first 22 months of science operations, Kepler had catalogued 2,740 candidate planets and 114 confirmed planets. These included the first rocky planet outside of our solar system. The gyroscopic problem began to plague Kepler as it approached the fourth anniversary of its launch. By the end of March, Kepler's fourth reaction wheel was experiencing additional transient friction in the form of torque spikes. This did not affect the collection of high-quality science data. In early April, Kepler was successfully rolled to a new attitude, and the data collected during March was radioed to Earth. On April the 18th, scientists announced the discovery of two planetary systems harbouring the three super-Earth-sized habitable zone planets. This brought the total habitable zone planets discovered by Kepler to five. By the end of April, the mission manager said the problematic reaction wheel number four appeared to have a deteriorating wheel bearing. All appropriate mitigation steps had been taken, he said. Engineering team members were not sure how long the wheel would continue to operate. The team members were developing contingency actions should the wheel fail. One of these contingencies was to preserve fuel so that the spacecraft could be pointed using thrusters. Twice during May, Kepler entered safe mode. The root cause was not known, but the proximate cause appeared to be an attitude error. Mission controllers found the spacecraft was oriented with the solar panels facing the sun. And that was the good news. The bad news was that Kepler was slowly spinning about the sun line. This spin caused the communication link to come and go. The folks in Mission Control knew they were in a serious strife when they commanded the spacecraft to stop rotating. Initially, it appeared that all three wheels responded and that the rotation had been successfully stopped. Unfortunately, reaction wheel 4 remained at full torque while the spin rate dropped to zero. This was regarded by the engineers to be a clear indication that there had been an internal failure within the reaction wheel. This was likely a structural failure of the wheel bearing. The spacecraft was then commanded to transition back to thruster-controlled safe mode. There was, in mid-May, enough fuel aboard Kepler to keep the craft with its antenna pointed earthward for several months. If the satellite were allowed to drift slightly in attitude while still maintaining contact with Earth, the fuel could last several years. Unfortunately, Kepler's telescopes were no longer pointing at their target stars. Consequently, the craft was now scientifically useless. NASA set up an anomaly review board and requested extra tracking time with the Deep Space Network. In the third week of May, Kepler was commanded to point rest state, reducing the rate of fuel usage. While disappointed at the cessation of data collection, scientists could draw comfort from the fact that Kepler had completed its primary 3.5-year mission. It had entered an extended mission phase in November last year. With data already collected, new findings are expected for years to come. For example, in early June, scientists added 1,924 new Kepler objects of interest to the NASA Exoplanet Archive. 503 of these were planet candidates. This brought the number of planet candidates found by Kepler to 3,216. On July 18, the Kepler engineering team initiated exploratory recovery tests on the two failed reaction control wheels. Now, reaction wheel 4 did not spin in the positive direction, but did turn in the negative direction. Wheel 2 spun in both directions. Further tests on the wheels were made in late July. In response to commands on July the 25th, wheel number 4 spun in both directions. Also, in late July, 63 more candidates were added to the catalogue of putative planets. The confirmed Kepler planet list now stood at 134. By the beginning of this month, both wheels were being spun bi-directionally, albeit with high friction levels. Engineers are now trying to characterize the stability of friction over time. A constant friction level may be correctable in Kepler's attitude control system. On the other hand, variable friction levels will likely render the wheels unusable. Efforts will concentrate on getting wheel number 2 working. Wheel 4 is considered probably beyond salvage. The Kepler engineering team will begin pointing performance testing tomorrow, August the 8th, and they plan to continue into next week if all goes well. By the end of this month, a determination of whether Kepler can return to exoplanet data collection will be made. Meanwhile, scientists continue to analyze the 4 years of data already collected by Kepler. Last week, they delivered their findings for 1,236 new Kepler objects of interest. Of these, 274 had been judged to be planet candidates. This brings the current count of Kepler planet candidates to 3,548. Well, 4 years ago, when the satellite was launched, Jane Platt, a public affairs officer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, spoke with Jim Franzen, the Kepler project manager. Here's how that conversation went.
Is there another Earth out there? I'm Jane Platt with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. The Kepler mission, launched March 6th from Cape Canaveral, Florida, is in orbit now, getting ready to stare into space and look for planets like our Earth that might be orbiting other stars. Kepler project manager Jim Franzen of JPL joins us.
Hi, Jane. It's nice to be with you.
Well, even without Kepler, astronomers had found more than 300 planets orbiting other stars, but none of them are like Earth. So Kepler is looking for planets like Earth. What exactly do we mean by that? What is Earth like?
What we mean by an Earth-like planet is to find a planet that's about the size of the Earth and that orbits its star at Earth-like distances. It orbits a star like our Sun at Earth-like distances. And that means that it orbits at a distance from the star where the temperature of the planet is not too hot and not too cold, but is just right for the presence of liquid water on the surface, where you can have oceans, you can have liquid water in which to have biochemistry, which we believe underlies all forms of life that we understand. So we're looking for a planet that could be habitable the way the Earth is.
Which leads to the next question, which is, what is the ultimate goal of Kepler?
Well, with Kepler, we're trying to answer the question, how frequently do planets like Earth, that is, planets the size of the Earth and orbiting in the habitable zone, how frequently do planets like that form around stars in our galaxy? As you said, we know of about 350 planets now orbiting other stars. But finding planets the size of the Earth in the habitable zone is an extremely difficult measurement to make, and that's what's driving us into space, try to make this measurement above the Earth's atmosphere where we can get much higher precision.
Tell us a little bit about the technique that Kepler's using to look for Earth-like planets.
Kepler is going to use a somewhat different technique from the method that's been used to find the bulk of the planets so far. We're going to use a technique called transits. And a transit is an easy thing to understand. It's simply a planet orbiting a star passing in front of the star as seen from our point of view, so that for a few hours as the planet orbits, it blocks some of the light from the star from reaching us. And we can measure that change in brightness or that slight dimming for the period of hours it takes a planet to go across the star. And so the planet will reveal itself by blocking part of the star's light, and it does that once per orbit. And so by that method, not only can we determine the size of the planet by the depth of the dimming, but we can also determine the orbital period or how far the planet is from the star. So there's a wealth of information that we can get from this technique.
So obviously this involves some pretty sophisticated technology. Tell me a little bit about the telescope and how it powerful it is and what it can do. And without getting into the nitty-gritty of it, just a little bit about how it works.
To do a measurement of how frequently Earth-like planets form, we need to look at a very large number of stars for a very long period of time. Most of the telescopes we build on the ground or we put in space, what we're trying to do is magnify things that are very far away and very faint, so we can get a very high-resolution look at what's going on in the distant universe. We have the opposite challenge with Kepler. We need a very large field of view so we can simultaneously look at a very large number of stars. So we've built a special kind of telescope called a Schmidt telescope, and the field of view is equal on the sky to two dips from the Big Dipper. So it's a 100 square degrees of sky, or another way to look at it, our field of view is about 30,000 times larger than the field of view of the Hubble Space Telescope. So it's a very different kind of telescope, and it allows us to stare at a region in the Milky Way galaxy rich in stars and monitor 100,000 stars simultaneously for a period of years.
Talk briefly about the camera on Kepler. It's a big camera.
As I mentioned, we need to look at a large number of stars. So not only does the telescope bring in this large field of view on the sky, but to image that and to collect the data, we need a very large camera. If you think of the detector that's in your pocket camera, your one-shot digital camera, it'll have a CCD or a charge coupled device in it that's about the size of your fingernail. The size of the focal plane on the Kepler camera is 1 square foot. So it's physically extremely large. It's the largest camera focal plane we've ever flown in space. And if you think of a camera you would buy for your private use, if you have a really good camera, you'll have a few megapixels. Well, the Kepler camera is 95 megapixels. It's just a very large camera by any measure.
You've been working on Kepler for a long time, as have many people on the team. It's really a nerve-wracking process getting a spacecraft launched and then getting it to work properly and getting confirmation it's working. You recently got an image with millions of stars. That must have been a really great day for you.
It was a great day. You know, you have a couple of critical events in the life of a mission like this. One of them is you light the fuse on the rocket, and you take this ride into space, and you hope everything goes well. In the case of Kepler, everything went extremely well. And then in the life of a telescope, another critical event is you take your first image, and you determine, are you in focus? Is everything working? Did you break any glass in the telescope? And we were very gratified with our first light image to see these millions of stars glittering across the focal plane. Everything was in excellent focus. Everything was working as designed. It was a tremendous relief and very gratifying.
Kepler is a 3.5-year mission. At the end of 3.5 years, what is your hope and what is the plan for what information and what knowledge we'll have that we didn't have before Kepler?
At the end of 3.5 years, we should know whether planets like the Earth are common or rare in the galaxy. We don't know whether Earths will be plentiful or whether the Earth is unique. And this is a question that has come down to us across 100 generations of human history. And we stand on a technology, finally, that allows us to answer this question scientifically. So at the end of 3.5 years, we're going to know whether there can be Star Trek in our future or whether there's no place to go.
More information on the Kepler mission is online at www.nasa.gov/Kepler. Thanks for joining us for this podcast from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
An interview by Jane Platt, Public Affairs Officer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and she was chatting there with Jim Franzen, the Kepler Project Manager, just after the launch and just at the beginning of the data collection or scientific data collection. Now, we have more about Kepler coming up in a moment.
This is Southern FM 88.3.
Now, the Kepler search for extrasolar planets has excited a lot of people, both within the space community and astronomical communities, but also well beyond. And we have a song here called the Kepler Blues, and it's sung by a singer known only as Mr. Campbell. And I think he's ready to go now.
When I was just a baby, my mama always said, there's laws governing the planets overhead. You know, I never believed a single word she said was true, until one day I got the Kepler's blues. I got the Kepler's blues, baby. I know just how those planets move. Number one, all planets move in ellipses around the sun. Two's about a line, carves out equal air and equal time. Three, the ratio of the period squared is equal to the ratio of the distances cubed. I got the Kepler's blues, baby. I know just how those planets move. If you learn laws of one, two, and three, in 2009, NASA's launching a satellite. It'll look at 100,000 stars and measure all their light. Using the transit method, it'll be able to determine if a planet's habitable. I got the Kepler's blues, baby. I know just how those planets move. If you learn laws of one, two, and three,
well, that was a guy called Mr. Campbell, and a song about Kepler, Johannes Kepler. who was after whom the Kepler satellite was named. And we're now going to go and have in a moment to tell you again who we are. But first up, in late July, the French Space Agency, the Centre National d'Etudes Spatiales, announced the retirement of the Kourou satellite. Now, this satellite was the, in many respects, the forerunner of Kepler. Now, Kourou, C-O-R-O-T, is an acronym for Convection, Rotation and Planetary Transits. The craft was launched in 2006 December, and it detected transiting exoplanets. Now, Kourou also measured acoustic oscillations in sun-like stars.
Just because we get around. I'm a gonna raise a fuss, I'm a gonna raise a holler.
You can hear all the best music from the 60s, 70s, 80s and today. Whether you like pop or rock, classical or jazz, Southern FM caters for all music tastes from every era. Tune in to 88.3 FM on your dial to hear the hits, the great hits of the past, present and the future.
Don't you wanna go for a ride? Just keep your hands inside and make the most out of life. Now don't you take it for granted.
On this evening's The Space Show, we are looking at the Kepler mission and its search for extrasolar planets, that is, planets orbiting stars other than our own. And this begs the question, well, how do stars get planets? How do planets form? Now, two NASA astronomers have done some computer modelling that shows how planets can affect the dust rings that surround new-formed planets.
Astronomers have just begun imaging planets around other stars. The technique isn't very advanced yet, and it can't see any planets as small as those in our own solar system. But let's suppose for a moment that alien astronomers are looking at our planetary system. Could they find any evidence that planets existed around the Sun, even if they couldn't see the planets themselves? The answer is probably yes. That's because at least one world in our solar system would make its presence known by its effects on a huge cloud of dust at the fringes of the solar system, in a place called the Kuiper Belt. The Kuiper Belt is a kind of cold storage zone out beyond Neptune, occupied by millions of icy bodies, including Pluto. The icy objects in the Kuiper Belt release dust that, from afar, could appear as a hazy disk at infrared wavelengths. New computer models created by NASA scientists, shown here, reveal what dust in the Kuiper Belt might look like to an alien astronomer. Neptune creates the intricate pattern. The massive planet's gravity tugs on the cloud's dust grains, nudging them in their orbits.
Neptune creates a ring structure in the dust cloud, which features a gap where the planet itself resides. And this gap should make it fairly easy to tell where Neptune is from afar, even at distances where the planet is too dim to detect directly. The supercomputer simulations that Mark Kushner and I performed also allow us to see what the dust in the solar system may have looked like when the solar system was much younger. In effect, we can go back in time and see how the distant view of the solar system may have changed.
In its youth, the Kuiper Belt contained many more objects and, consequently, lots more dust. In fact, the dust was so thick that the particles themselves often collided.
When we included collisions between dust particles, we were really amazed by what we saw.
Successively younger models of the Kuiper Belt dust cloud show progressively simpler structure, eventually leading to a single narrow ring beyond Neptune's orbit.
Dust collisions change Neptune's gravitational imprint. The gap in the ring structure disappears. The amazing thing is we've already seen ring structures like this around other younger stars, like Fomalhaut. In terms of dust, we now know that these other systems may look similar to our young solar system.
Dust around other stars can tell us a lot about possible planets. Just as in our own solar system, it could reveal Neptune.
And that report came courtesy of the Goddard Space Flight Center. Now, with the Kepler satellite well and truly into its mission, Tony Phillips filed this report on how it had discovered five more exoplanets.
Kepler discovers five exoplanets, presented by Science at NASA. January 4th, 2010. NASA's Kepler Space Telescope, designed to find Earth-sized planets in the habitable zone of Sun-like stars, has discovered its first five new exoplanets. Named Kepler 4b, 5b, 6b, 7b, and 8b, the planets were announced on Monday, January 4th, by members of the Kepler science team during a news briefing at the American Astronomical Society meeting in Washington, D.C. The discovery showed that our science instrument is working well, says William Borucki of NASA's Ames Research Center in Moffett Field, California. Borucki is the mission's science principal investigator. Indications are, he says, that Kepler will meet all its science goals. The five planets are quite a bit larger than Earth. Known as hot Jupiters because of their high masses and extreme temperatures, the new exoplanets range in size from similar to Neptune to larger than Jupiter. They have orbits ranging from 3.3 to 4.9 days. Estimated temperatures of the planets range from 2200 to 3000 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than molten lava and much too hot for life as we know it. It's gratifying to see the first Kepler discoveries rolling off the assembly line, says John Morse, director of the Astrophysics Division at NASA headquarters in Washington. We expected Jupiter-sized planets in short orbits to be the first planets Kepler could detect. It's only a matter of time before more Kepler observations lead to smaller planets with longer period orbits, coming closer and closer to the discovery of the first Earth analog. Launched on March 6, 2009 from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida, the Kepler mission continuously and simultaneously observes more than 150,000 stars. Kepler's science instrument, or photometer, already has measured hundreds of possible planet signatures that are being analyzed now. Kepler looks for the signatures of planets by measuring dips in the brightness of stars. When planets cross in front of or transit their stars, as seen from Earth, they periodically block the starlight. The size of the planet can be derived from the size of the dip. The temperature can be estimated from the characteristics of the star at orbits and the planet's orbital period. While many of the signatures detected so far are likely to be something other than a planet, such as small stars orbiting larger stars, ground-based observatories have confirmed the existence of the first five exoplanets. The discoveries are based on approximately 6 weeks' worth of data collected since science operations began on May 12, 2009. Kepler will continue science operations until at least November 2012. It will search for planets as small as Earth, including those that orbit stars in a warm habitable zone where liquid water could exist on the surface of the planet. Since transits of planets in the habitable zone of solar-like stars occur about once a year and require three transits for verification, it is expected to take at least 3 years to locate and verify an Earth-sized planet. According to Borucki, Kepler's continuous and long-duration search should greatly improve scientists' ability to determine the distributions of planet size and orbital period in the future. Today's discoveries are a significant contribution to that goal, Borucki says. The Kepler observations will tell us whether there are many stars with planets that could harbor life, or whether we might be alone in our galaxy. For more information about the Kepler mission, please visit the mission's homepage at nasa.gov/Kepler. This story was read by Tony Phillips and presented by Science at NASA. To find more Science at NASA stories on the internet, please visit science.nasa.gov.
And Tony works at the Marshall Space Flight Center, which is in Huntsville, Alabama. Now, the Kepler mission is not the only one that is hunting for planets around other stars. The Spitzer Space Telescope is also doing the same, in quite a different way, of course. And Daniel Brennan has a report on how Earth-like planets can form in the habitable zone around a star.
Is an Earth-like planet forming 424 light-years away in a star system called HD113766? New observations of this faraway system from NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope has some astronomers saying, yes, hello, I'm Daniel Brennan.
The Spitzer Space Telescope podcast is part of a series highlighting recent discoveries in infrared astronomy. It's produced by NASA's Spitzer Science Center at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. The Spitzer mission is managed by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
We may be one step closer to the elusive goal of finding Earth-like planets around other stars, but for this one, we'll have to wait a while. According to Dr. Carrie Liss of the Applied Physics Laboratory at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, all the pieces for forming an Earth-like planet seem to fit together in the case of star system HD 113766. It contains a huge belt of warm dust, enough to build a Mars-sized planet or larger. The belt is currently clumping into the beginnings of a rocky planet, and this is happening right in the middle of the system's terrestrial habitable zone. This is the region around a star where liquid water could exist on any rocky planet that might form. In addition to being in the right location, this dusty belt is also swirling around the right star, one that is just a little more massive than our sun. Liss notes that HD 113766 is also just the right age for forming rocky Earth-like planets at approximately 10 million years old. If the system were too young, its planet-forming disk would be full of gas, and it would be making gas giant planets like Jupiter. If the system were too old, the dust clumping would have already occurred, and all the system's rocky planets would have already formed. But there's more to forming an Earth-like planet than just being in the right place at the right time and around the right star. It's also about the right mix of dusty materials. Using Spitzer's infrared spectrometer, Liss's team determined that the material in HD 113866 is more processed than the snowball-like stuff that makes up infant solar systems and comets, which are considered cosmic refrigerators because they contain pristine ingredients from the early solar system. But the material is also not as processed as the stuff found in mature planets and asteroids. This means the dust belt must be in a transitional phase, when rocky planets are just beginning to form. For the Spitzer Science Center, I'm Daniel Brennan.
To find out more about this topic, visit our website at www.spitzer.caltech.edu. You can browse our image galleries, read about the latest results, and subscribe to our newsletter. On behalf of NASA's Spitzer Science Center, thanks for listening.
Online all the time at southernfm.com.au.
On this evening's The Space Show, we are looking at the Kepler mission, which unfortunately looks like it may be over. And yes, no, don't give up yet, though. They have saved many other missions. Now, we're going to have a talk now about how life could have begun, because having found all these planets, the big question is, well, could there be life on them? Now, Paul Davies was interviewed by the good folks at the Earth and Sky about how life on Earth began, and of course that might lead us into how it could have begun on other planets as well.
Earth and Sky.
There's been a lot of research on the setting in which life on Earth may have begun, and there are various fashions, but one of these is that it might have started hot and deep.
You're listening to astrophysicist Paul Davies of Arizona State University. He studies the origins of life on our planet.
It may well have started 1 or 2 kilometers beneath the seabed near one of the volcanic vents that are so common, where the internal heat of the Earth comes up and meets the ocean and creates thermal pandemonium.
Tiny microbes called extremophiles have been discovered living in the extreme heat of these sea vents.
I think that offers a possible setting so that life may have begun deep down under the ground and then only later evolved and adapted to cooler surface conditions on Earth.
Davies added that scientists still know little of how life started.
Scientifically, we know better off now than we were 30 or 40 years ago, the scientific facts are more or less the same. We still have no theory of how life began. It could be it is an exceptionally rare thing, or it could be it is something that's more or less automatic and will happen wherever there are the right conditions. So the obvious way to test that is to look for it happening many times on Earth.
More interviews with scientists at our website. I'm Lindsay Patterson. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Well, you're listening to the Space Show with Andrew Rennie. Now, we've got a little story here about Spitzer and the stages of star formation. Now, this is not planet formation. This is star formation. And we're just about ready to go with that now. And here we go.
Astronomers working with the Spitzer Space Telescope have recently had some rather strange observations of a young star. Something appears to be pushing around a large clump of material that is in orbit of this star. And it's moving fast enough to make a difference in observations along a 5-month period. And these observations have given the team working with the Spitzer Space Telescope a rare new look into the early stages of planetary formation. Hello, I'm Mark Halu. Astronomers know that after a star has been born, it still retains a large amount of dust, gas, and sometimes larger pieces of debris that remain in orbit. Over a period of time, typically measured in millions of years, these materials flatten out into a large pancake-like disk, and then clump together, forming larger and larger bodies. Over time, full-sized planets form, and a more mature and stable planetary system settles in, much like our own solar system. The predominant theory of planet formation is based on the idea that once a star and its orbiting dust clouds have settled, the gas and dust and debris begin a snowball effect, slowly gathering up more and more material through orbits, eventually creating large enough bodies that carve out paths of the gas and debris. Over time, most of this material will get picked up by the forming planets, but sometimes a ring of debris is left behind, much like the asteroid belt in our own solar system. Before the launch of the Spitzer Space Telescope in 2003, there were only a handful of stars that were known to have these forming planetary disks around them. But with Spitzer's infrared vision, dozens more of these transitional systems have been found around our Milky Way galaxy. The Spitzer Space Telescope has been able to look in on these forming planetary systems, and scientists are able to determine how far along in the development process the planets are by measuring the amount of light being reflected by the system. James Musserol and his team at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, began their examination of these existing transitional disks when they started to take a closer look at the LRLL-31 star system, spending almost 5 months observing their stunning astronomical find. While observing the LRLL-31 system over a 5-month period, Musserol and his research team had the opportunity to see a peculiar facet in the planetary development of this star system. Results from their observing showed some very unexpected behavior of reflected light, oftentimes showing large differences in observations over as little time as a week. The observations have been showing light reflecting from the inner region of the star's disk, changing predominantly at a bi-weekly rate. James Musserol is the first author on a paper recently published on these exciting new observations. We don't know if planets have formed or will form, but we are gaining a better understanding of the properties and dynamics of the fine dust that could either become or indirectly shape a planet. This is a unique, real-time glimpse into the lengthy process of planet building. One explanation to these wild results is that some object, maybe an already developed planet or even a nearby star, is exerting some extreme gravitational forces onto the disk material. These forces are causing waves and large lumps in the planetary material as it orbits the star. This companion object that Musserol and his team believe is orbiting the star is theorized to be much closer in distance to the star than our planet Earth is to our own sun, possibly a tenth of the distance. The distance also explains the speed at which the object must be traveling. which is also why the astronomers are able to view the changes around this star in such a small time scale. The astronomical team at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, will continue to follow up their breakthrough discovery with ground-based telescopes in order to get a better look at the companion object in orbit and to see how the disks are forming. The Spitzer Space Telescope will continue to peer in on LRLL-31 to help keep track of changes in the star system. For the Spitzer Science Center, I'm Mark Helou.
And we'll keep you up to date with what's happening with Kepler. Do they manage to salvage the mission in the coming weeks? We'll keep you posted with the space show here on 88.3 Southern FM.
Or tune to the great southern sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.